of Creighton University's Department of History. He is the author of Schindler's List, the novel upon which the award-winning film of the same title was based. He now returns with the bestseller, The Great Shame and the Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking world. In a moment, we will talk with Thomas Keneally about his latest work. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. In the 21st century, it is commonplace to find large numbers of women in the nation's universities. But when the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention gathered during this week in 1848, higher education was still not an option for American women. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott organized the convention, the first of its kind, to rectify this and other inequities. After meeting with other women's rights advocates while in London attending an anti-slavery conference, Stanton and Mott returned to the States and published an announcement in the Seneca Falls, New York County Courier, advertising their gathering to the world. Stanton drew up a declaration of sentiments that not only called for a vote on 12 radical resolutions, but that also co-opted the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, replacing phrases like, "All men are created equal," with "All men and women are created equal," and changing all references to King George to men as the oppressor. Although the delegation divided over the call for the immediate enfranchisement of women, giving them the right to vote, it did unanimously adopt the 11 other resolutions. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, 5 centuries after the first Spanish sailors reached the New World, archaeologists believe they have located the headless remains of a conquistador in the destroyed city of León Viejo. The Nicaraguan city, a bustling settlement during the Age of Exploration, was founded by Spaniard Hernandez de Cordoba in the early 16th century. But when Nicaragua's governor suspected Cordoba of treason, he had him decapitated and his head mounted for public display. According to the researchers, Cordoba's body was found in a church that was reserved for burying citizens of high social rank. In what has become a year memorializing those Americans whose lives were lost in battle during World War II, the National D-Day Museum recently opened its doors to the public in New Orleans, Louisiana. The museum's location is important for many reasons, chief among them being that New Orleans was the epicenter of the mass production of planes, aircraft carriers, and the thousands of attack boats that played such a crucial role on the beaches of Normandy. The museum's founder, historian Stephen Ambrose, hopes that the might of an aroused democracy will be celebrated by all those who tour the various displays throughout the memorial. According to Ambrose, New Orleans was one of the many cities during the war that witnessed a complete transcendence of the American spirit. Quote, "The people of New Orleans came together, black and white, old and young, men and women, to propel the war effort." You're listening to Talking History. In the 19th century, Ireland lost half of its population to famine, emigration to the United States and Canada, and the forced transportation of convicts to Australia. The ancestors of our guest today, Thomas Keneally, who lives in Australia, were among the victims of that tragedy. The name sounds familiar. Keneally is the author of the award-winning book Schindler's List, which was the inspiration for Steven Spielberg's Academy Award-winning film. Thomas Keneally is with us today to talk about his latest best-selling book on the bit of Irish history to which I just referred, and it is titled The Great Shame and the Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking World. Welcome, Mr. Keneally, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's a great honor. Thank you.
Let's start off by having you explain to us, if you would, the part of the title, The Great Shame. What does that refer to?
Well, as I say at the end of the book, it has a number of meanings, but I think that there's no getting away from the fact that a great shame attached to the government at Westminster, the British government of the day, in its maladministration of Ireland and in its maladministration of the famine. There were many reasons for that maladministration, which I try to explain in the book. But, of course, it produced a great trigger of immigration and politics. That is, it produced the famine. And So the primary meaning of the Great Shame was that Ireland was actually, compared to where I come from, Australia, another part of the British Empire, Ireland very badly governed.
So at least in this sense of the word or of the phrase, you're in the school of historians that suggest that it was the maladministration that made the famine much worse than it might have been under ordinary circumstances.
Yes, and needless to say, like most people, I'm in favor of the peace process, but I don't think that the peace process is helped at all by fudging these issues. I explain in the book, for example, that the British people showed an exceptional compassion for the Irish through its donations to the British Association, which was an NGO, an aid body operating in Ireland, and the British people thus showed greater goodwill than the British government. Of course, I've never been a supporter of the concept which, as I explained in the book, began to gain form in the late 1860s, that for the sake of the famine, for the sake of the peculiar griefs of Ireland, random Englishmen and women on the street should have to die by dynamiting. I've never belonged to that school. On the other hand, I've never belonged to the school that says, well, we mustn't say these things because it might encourage a problem. I think that to confront and forgive is the way to go. And I was heartened during the writing of the book by the fact that Prime Minister Blair of Great Britain apologized for the misgovernment of Ireland at the time of the famine.
Right. Now, the second part of the title, The Triumph of the Irish in the English-Speaking World. What did you mean to suggest there?
Well, I have to confess, Dr. LeBeau, that unlike a strict scholar like yourself, I was influenced by my editor, Nan Talese, at Doubleday, to sling that one in, that subtitle in. But there was a triumph. What is amazing is that few immigrants, other than, of course, the slaves of Africa, from Africa, arrived in the Americas or in Australia in a worse condition than the Irish. Of course, some of the ones sent to Australia were convicts, like my wife's and my forebears. But they did very quickly begin to garner a position for themselves in mainstream society. And the history of the Irish in America has been the success of that ascent. I deal in the book with some ironies of this triumph. One of my most beloved convicts who served time in Australia was an Irish political prisoner called Thomas Francis Maher, an extraordinarily engaging figure. But when Maher went to Montana, escaped to the U.S., was a Civil War general, and then went to Montana as governor, his sense of the dispossession of the Irish did not extend itself to the Flathead Indians on the west of the Rockies or to the Blackfoot on the east of the Rockies. He felt that they could easily sacrifice more of their land, and he couldn't understand their particular ancestral passion for the land because they didn't seem to be doing a lot with it. So that one of the dents in the triumph was that the Irish did not always extend their experience, the imagination they received from being oppressed themselves, to later comers to America, or to former African slaves, or to Native Americans. But there was a triumph as organizations like Tammany Hall began to use the Irish as political cannon fodder, as electors, meeting them at the ship and immediately enrolling them as voters. The Irish refused to be merely electoral cannon fodder and began to find their own place. And that happened that same political impulse happened even with the Irish radicals and rural protesters who were sent as convicts to Australia too. The Irish political imagination, I think, Dr. LeBeau, came very strongly from the influence of the Liberator, Daniel O'Connell, who had involved the ordinary tenant farmers and peasants of Ireland in two mass movements. One was Catholic emancipation to achieve the an end to any discriminatory laws against Catholics, and the second was the repeal movement to cancel the connection between Britain and Ireland by constitutional, non-violent means. And ordinary peasants, like my wife's great-grandparents, my wife's great-grandfather before he was transported, were allowed to belong to these associations. And though they had no vote at all, they were behind the man who spoke for them in Westminster, and so Daniel O'Connell and his Irish party. So the Irish got a powerful political sense from this experience, and it helped them to triumph in America and indeed in most of the New World.
You know, you make some several good points in there. One that I'd like to pick up on, and it's sort of a wake-up call to those of us historians who get too narrowly focused, is how difficult it is to understand an aspect of history without making the connections that you make in your book. We study Irish immigration to the United States. We don't focus terribly on what's going on in Ireland, and we never touch on what's going on in Australia. Yet in several of your characters, they come to the United States, like Maher, through Australia as criminals. So there's a connection here that I think you stress very well in your book.
Yes, and indeed, you find in the book an extraordinary alliance between Yankee Protestant temperance sea captains who are willing to liberate from Australian prisoners, Australian prisons, various Irish prisoners who are, of course, different in culture, different in religion, probably different in drinking habits, too. And this is one of the most fascinating alliances of the 19th century, the alliance between the disgruntled Yankee captain who helps political prisoners escape to the U.S. And the Irish radical who comes to the U.S. and, of course, gets involved, as Maher did, in Democrat politics. And it is a fascinating story in this sense that through Thomas Francis Maher, you can look at, through all of these convicts, you can look at Ireland, the grievances of Ireland, what politicized people. You can look at the Australian exile of these people who were shipped off 120, 130 days at sea, in many cases in chains or battened down on the prison deck. And you can see the Australian experience through their eyes. You can then follow them in their escapes, in their very spectacular escapes from Australia, often on whalers, and follow them into America. And you become aware that, very like Zionism in the 20th century, the Irish movement in the 19th century was an international one, in that money for various Irish enterprises, including revolutionary enterprises, but also famine relief and hardship relief, that was an international movement. And this is shown towards the end of the book when the Clan na Gael, a large Irish revolutionary organization in the United States, gathers money, buys a new Bedford whaler, and dispatches it throughout across the world to Western Australia to rescue the last of the life-serving Fenians or Irish Republicans there in 1876. Now, the money to buy that boiler came from California, where a great uncle of mine, a liberated prisoner from Australia, was the treasurer of the movement. It came from Chicago. It came from Cincinnati. It came from New York and Boston. It also came from Montreal. It came from the gold fields of New Zealand, where the Irish were rife. Wherever there was a gold field, you had the Irish. It came from the gold fields of Queensland, where the Irish were rife, Queensland being a northern state of Australia. It came from New South Wales, my state. So you had a sense of an international movement with the left hand knowing what the right hand was doing, which spanned the Pacific Ocean, spanned the Atlantic, and I think, therefore, that what you said earlier is correct. It's hard to get the holistic picture unless you do follow one of these prisoners from place to place, from Ireland into exile in Australia, into the huge Irish organizations, the Fenian Brotherhood, the Clan na Gael, the Democrat Party, which operated in the U.S., you can, since they are a movable lens, rather as Schindler was a movable lens upon every aspect of the Holocaust, these men and women encountered many aspects of the Irish movement.
Okay. We only have a couple minutes left, but I want to get back to the point I raised earlier about your having relatives here interspersed throughout the pages, your ancestors. You mentioned one, if I recall, isn't Thomas Maher, an ancestor of yours, and also the wonderful character Hugh Larkin, I believe, is a relative of your wife. Would you like to talk about them for a moment?
Yes, indeed. Hugh Larkin was, I deal with him because he was a typical peasant activist. The peasantry of Ireland held tenure, land tenure, that was very insecure. They were utterly dependent upon their land for survival. Often it was half an acre, quarter of an acre, on which they grew potatoes, the famous potatoes, kept a pig in their cabin and so on. They're utterly dependent upon this land, so that they organized people like Hugh Larkin into informal but oath-bound peasant groups called the Ribbon Men. And Hugh Larkin, on his ship to Australia, of 218 prisoners, there were over 70 Ribbon Men. And so ribbon offenses were very common, resistance to landlordism, basically. And he was my wife's great-grandfather. Thomas Francis Maher was not, sadly, an ancestor of mine. I'd be very proud to claim him. But John Keneally, who was an Irish Republican in post-Civil War era, transported to Australia on the last convict ship, he was an ancestor. And you see in his life the Irish radicalism, but you also see the way the Irish adapted themselves to pluralist America very creatively, the way every immigrant group, if it's going to be successful, has to adapt itself to the pluralism of these new countries like the United States. So I used some of my ancestors as, again, as a lens or a litmus test, as typical people of the great Irish catastrophe of the 19th century.
Well, in just a few seconds we have left, would you care to tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, actually, yes, I'm working in New York on a non-fiction book, which I hope might come out next year. It's much smaller than The Great Shame, but it's about women. It's about women in the 19th century and the way they were put in perda, the ones who were seen to have sinned. And I'm following the career of a woman who was married to a Union general called Daniel Sickles. Daniel Sickles killed her lover, and she was a young woman in her 20s. And I show how society destroyed her for her peccadilloes. It's a long way from Monica Lewinsky, but the code of ethics was very, very different. But disreputability, which many conservative politicians in America believe didn't exist in the past, they're always talking about returning to traditional values. Nonetheless, some of the traditional values were quite horrifying, and I suppose that's the message that I'm telling in this little story. This is very small canvas. Great Shame is very long, large canvas, but at least the new book will be easier to carry around than the Great Shame is.
Very good. Sounds like one we'll need to get back to you on. It sounds like a great book. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Not at all.
You've been listening to Thomas Keneally, author of The Great Shame and the Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking world. And this is Talking History. Immigration is an important part of our history, but it is not simply an element of our past. It continues today with equally significant impact on immigrants and the nations to which they choose to emigrate. Poet and essayist Eamon Wall's most recent book, From the Chennai to the Black Hills, is on that very subject. It is an exploration of the lives of contemporary Irish immigrants to the United States. Here is Eamon Wall reading an excerpt from his book.
Those days when I wasn't working, I enjoyed going round the corner to Chris and Louis Discount. They were immigrants from Greece, buying a newspaper, a cup of coffee, best coffee in New York, Louis said, and some sweets for the kids, and then heading up Broadway, pushing the stroller in the direction of Inwood Park. I was Louis's sometime secretary. If he was having difficulty communicating with the Times, the News, or the Post, he'd ask me to phone on his behalf. He thought that I spoke the same kind of English the people in the billing sections of the city's newspapers did. I shouted at the people on the other end of the line to get their respect. Shouting became my standard telephone technique. It was the only method that worked for me in New York. Louis's hands were black from handling the papers, and I remember him bent over the sports pages of the Greek newspaper, reading the reports of soccer games from Europe. We shared a common language, Gullit, Shearer, Platini, Barcelona, Maradona, which brought us close, separating me from the Americans, or Yankees as he called them with a smile, who came into his shop. This is why some mornings Louis would place a stack of bills on the counter, hand me the phone, and say the coffee's free today. Of course, the Dominicans spoke this language too, but they had their own newspaper shops, their own loyalties. It was to their bodegas I went in the evenings for bottles of beer and quarts of milk. There men stood talking in groups and parted to let me through. The Dominicans knew, too, that Jack Charlton managed the Irish soccer team. One morning, in typical New York fashion, the shop was closed, Louis was gone, and the rumor went round that he was working in a restaurant in Connecticut. So I transferred my business for what it was worth to a shop on Broadway owned by a man from Galicia in Spain. We are both Celts, he said to me when he got to know me better. Later, when I told him I was leaving New York to live in Nebraska, he shook his head and moaned, "You are leaving New York to live in America. God help you." I can still see Pedro leaning across the counter to make a point. He is always smiling. I often think of Louis in Connecticut working in a diner. They have diners in Connecticut. He must be the counterman pouring coffee, yelling orders taken over the phone at the chef, smiling as he hands you back your change. Maybe he's telling the customers that he's happy to be out of the crazy city, or maybe he remembers New York fondly. I know he misses Greece and is saving money to go home. The old story. I think, too, of the immigrant businesses which define New York for me. Newspaper shops and kiosks underground, bakeries, diners, delis, and fruit vendors. I think, too, that each moment in the city men and women are reading, are looking forward to reading, newspapers which tell the news of their homelands. And I see myself leaning over their shoulders, sharing in their excitement and anticipation, like a child who, unable to read, studies the pictures carefully and invents the narrative.
You've been listening to Eamon Wall reading from his new book, From the Chennai to the Black Hills. Professor Wall is the Jefferson Smurfit Chair in Irish Studies at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. This is Talking History. Continuing on our theme of Irish-American history, we have selected for our site of the week a museum that you can visit to learn more about this fascinating subject. Here to tell you more about that site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located in East Durham, New York, the Irish-American Heritage Museum records and presents the unique history and heritage of the sons and daughters of Ireland in America. The current exhibit, The Irish in Religion, that runs through October 9th of this year, highlights the many contributions of the religious orders of Ireland that traveled to America. Some of the museum's collection can be viewed at various sites in New York as well. Contact the Irish American Heritage Museum in East Durham for more information about the exhibits.
For our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we would like to call to your attention two programs that will air on the History Channel next week. Beginning on Monday, July 24th, and running for four consecutive evenings, the History Channel will premiere Mummies, Tales from the Egyptian Crypts. The four-hour series looks at the burial places of the mummies and construction of the pyramids, both intended to honor the dead. It also examines the process of mummification. In 1212, two 12-year-old boys began their own crusade to recapture the Holy Land from the forces of Islam. Thousands of other children tagged along in what became known as the Children's Crusade. They sought to rectify what earlier groups of medieval warriors were unable to accomplish. The Children's Crusade, which airs on the History Channel on Wednesday, July 26, reveals the ultimate price these innocents paid in this spiritual war. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact time of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will celebrate the 1,000th anniversary of the Vikings landing in America by taking a look at the latest research on the subject and separating fact from fiction. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.